This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota this Sunday morning. Today's show will feature two conversations from last week. One with Dr. Joan Connell, the chair of the Physician Advisory Committee for the North Dakota Department of Health. The other with Peter Bick, an Arizona State University professor and documentary filmmaker with a deep interest in sustainable agriculture. First, though, we'll begin with an update about the COVID-19 pandemic from our news director, Dave Thompson.
Governor Doug Burgum has received some national attention after an emotional plea against mask shaming. It came during his Friday briefing. Here's what Burgum told reporters.
I would really love to see in North Dakota that we could just skip this thing that other parts of the nation are going through, where they're creating a divide, either it's ideological or political or something, around mask versus no mask. This is a, I would say, senseless dividing line, and I would ask people to try to dial up your empathy and your understanding. If someone is wearing a mask, they're not doing it to represent what political party they're in or what candidates they support. They might be doing it because they've got a five-year-old child who's been going through cancer treatments. They might have vulnerable adults in their life who are currently have COVID and are fighting. And so, again, I would just love to see our state, as part of being North Dakota smart, also be North Dakota kind, North Dakota empathetic, North Dakota understanding to do this thing. Because if somebody wants to wear a mask, there should be no mask shaming. You should look at them and say, that person's wearing a mask because for them, there's additional risk in their life.
At that briefing, Burgum also announced that some of the enforceable rules are now going to be strongly suggested recommendations. His executive order amendment removes references to compliance, enforcement, and penalties, putting the responsibility on individuals and businesses and their customers.
It's clear that even as we loosen up these and move from legal requirements to just simply recommendations or guidelines for those businesses that had previously during the middle of this pandemic been closed by executive order, that both the local health officer and the state health officer, between those two, they've got clear legal authority about requesting quarantines. The state health officer still has clear legal authority to close businesses that represent health risks to the public. And so again, somebody decides they want to let it rip, and there's a large breakout that's traced back to those, to that either facility, whether it's a business or a place where customers go, there still is the ability, and we will, to protect public safety, take actions as needed to make sure that we're ensuring public health. So again, this is up to each business to make the smart decisions about how they restore their customer and consumer confidence, and they take actions that allow them not only to reopen, but to stay open, operating a safe and healthy business.
Burgum says the state capitol will reopen June 1st. But he's also said there will likely be some permanent changes for some state workers following what has happened during the COVID-19 pandemic. Many state employees have been working from home.
I think a lot of people have learned, including state employees, that they can be very productive working from home if they've got the right home environment and the right equipment.
Burgum says this could become the new norm for some of the employees.
When you, quote, come back to work and reopen the Capitol, it may be a hybrid. It may be that there are certain managers and leaders that come back and work every single day out of the Capitol, and there may be other classes of workers that will, come in 2 days a week, well, and then on the days when they're not there, somebody else comes in 2 days a week.
Burgum says the state owns and leases a lot of property across North Dakota, and a real estate study is now underway concerning that property.
There will be new thinking, new approaches on the best way to work, not only from a health standpoint, but also from a productivity standpoint. And I also think from a customer service, we talk a lot about wanting to treat taxpayers and citizens as the customers they are. And I think, again, if we can create a situation where a citizen can get a service without having to come to the Capitol, that's a good deal.
The chancellor of the North Dakota University System says the state's 11 campuses have experienced what seems like 10 years of history over the course of 2 months. Due to the pandemic, the campuses began virtual classes March 23rd. Mark Hagerot says in a matter of several days, instructors shifted 11,000 classes and tens of thousands of students to online courses. Hagerot says advisory teams are at work now on how the universities will handle classes, cafeteria functions, sporting events, and many other matters when the fall semester begins in August.
Fortunately, we've got a couple months to sort this out. And I'm telling you, it's being studied across the country. Universities are all tackling these type of questions. So we have an obligation, even though there is some risk, obviously, there's more risk coming out of your basement driving on the road, let's face it. But, you know, I'm an old ship captain. If a ship captain never left port, hey, he'd be at zero risk, but that wouldn't be much of a fleet, would it? You know, so we recognize there's a risk balance we've got to take here.
The city of Minot has a goal to get to the 50,000 population level in the 2020 census.
By achieving 50,000 residents, we would be eligible for additional sources of federal funding, community development block grants. We can also would be eligible for Metropolitan Planning Organization funding for long-range transportation planning.
Brian Billingsley is Minot's Community and Economic Development Director. He says the city is making an effort to make sure all Minot residents are counted in the census.
Trying to reach out to groups of people who may not live here full-time. They could be airmen, college students, oil field workers, snowbirds. Want to make sure as we count as many of those people as possible, residents of Minot and as North Dakota.
Billingsley says he's not quite as confident of that 50,000 mark as he was a few months ago before the coronavirus pandemic and the downturn in the oil markets.
I don't know how many oil workers have left the state, and if they're not in the state, it's going to be very difficult to count them as residents of North Dakota.
But Billingsley says Minot still has a legitimate shot, and he says it helps that the administration has extended the deadline for residents to fill out their census forms until October 1st. There will be no Minnesota State Fair this year. The fair board voted unanimously to cancel the event. Here's General Manager Jerry Hammer.
We all love the fair, and that's exactly why we can't have a fair this year. This is about playing the long game. This is about the future of the fair. This isn't about doing something now. This isn't about risking everything on a bad bet. This is about doing the right thing for the future of the fair.
Since 1859, the Minnesota State Fair has only been canceled due to the Civil War, World War II, and the polio epidemic of 1946. For Main Street Weekend, I'm Dave Thompson.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Dr. Joan Connell was our guest last Tuesday. She's been working with state leaders during the pandemic, and our conversation began when I asked her to describe the role of the Physicians Advisory Committee she chairs.
Within a day of understanding that coronavirus had reached the United States, Tim Weidrich reached out to me and informed me that we were going to need a physician advisory group to bounce things off of as part of the incident command. So he invited me to collect a group of physicians that could serve as that sounding board for incident command. And so our strategy was to try to include physicians from each institution around North Dakota with a variety of different types of expertise. And we have steadily grown. It soon evolved into adding local public health leaders. And I think that was a really nice addition. And now, as we continue to evolve and physicians become involved in different ways by offering expertise on a given topic, for example, then they get included into the fold. So it's become a wonderfully diverse group of North Dakota physicians who are really committed to optimizing health for their patients and the rest of our citizens.
How does the group work? How often do you meet? How is the agenda set? And I know the governor has almost a daily briefing about COVID-19 progress in the state. How do you work with the executive staff?
So we are established through the North Dakota Department of Health. So we meet Thursday evenings virtually, and then we also have additional meetings as needed. and we will reach out to our Department of Health leadership and ask for any issues or items that they might request counsel on. And then we, you know, ask the specific questions they would like to have answered. And then those are the items up for discussion during the meeting.
What would be an ideal testing environment for the state of North Dakota?
Well, I think that very much depends upon what your goal for testing is.
What should it be?
That depends upon the environment. When we think about taking care of patients who might have symptoms and be sick with COVID, what we would like is a patient to be able to go to a healthcare facility and safely receive testing with a relatively prompt response. And then also have that patient receive appropriate guidance about self-isolating until they get the test results, et cetera, to limit the potential spread of the infection. When we're talking about long-term care facilities, we would like to have regular screening of healthcare workers plus minus patients so that we are able to detect infection in healthcare workers who might be asymptomatically shedding the virus to other care workers and to other patients. And so that requires repetitive testing at a given interval to catch these healthcare workers who might inadvertently be bringing the infection into the nursing home or other long-term care facility and pulling them out of the group until they've resolved their infection.
Is there any utility to sort of random testing, doing a snapshot to find out typically how many people might be asymptomatic in a certain population? Or is the testing usually directed at people who might be most at risk or dealing with symptoms?
Well, I think all of those answers apply when we think about surveillance testing. For example, answering the question of what is our estimate of the number of people in Bismarck who might be sick with COVID at this moment? And I say sick, but who might be infected with COVID because they may or may not have symptoms, versus what is that in this moment in time? How many people might test positive for COVID in Fargo or in Rugby? So understanding where we are with the amount of circulating active virus in a community is very useful in determining how we're doing with social distancing, projecting how many people are going to get infected in the next few weeks. And also, once we have a large enough proportion of the population who has tested positive, then our antibody testing will actually potentially become more useful for surveillance testing in determining what is the prevalence of COVID-19 in a given community and in our state. Then finally, we could build upon that by determining how close are we to achieving herd immunity, such that our most vulnerable would be protected because we all have had the disease, and assuming that that antibodies will be protective and are long-lasting, so we could protect our most vulnerable that way while we're waiting for a vaccine and other treatments.
Now, herd immunity usually involves a significant percentage of the population having been exposed to the virus. Is there a guesstimate of what the percentage of the population of North Dakota has currently been exposed to the virus?
So I am not exactly sure of that data. I have been told about 1%.
And proper herd immunity would be something in the neighborhood of like 70% or...
60 to 70%, exactly, Doug. So we're a ways from that, which is why, you know, these more basic elements of social distancing and excellent hygiene are really, really important now, particularly while we're still trying to understand and gain access to effective treatments for the virus.
Dr. Joan Connell is chair of the Physician Advisory Committee for the North Dakota Department of Health. We're talking about the role of the committee in advising state leaders about how to best deal with COVID-19 and the state's response to it. You mentioned the asymptomatic complication of this kind of infection, that lots of people, apparently a significant percentage, can have been infected by it but not show any symptoms. What would the typical symptoms of COVID-19 be? Do we have a pretty good sense of that now?
Yes. Well, we certainly are concerned about people who have a fever. We also see that it's been associated with cough, sore throat, runny nose, loss of smell and taste has been associated. And then we also see that people who are sick with coronavirus sometimes have body aches and fatigue. And finally, there are some symptoms that in some populations where they've had a nausea, diarrhea, and some vomiting.
For a few weeks now, the Fargo-Moorhead area on the eastern edge of North Dakota has been a hot spot. It's accounted for a very significant portion of the state's COVID-19 cases. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. And I think that I have heard that a lot of this is a lot of our positive cases in Fargo are tied to healthcare facilities and to manufacturing. So situations where, you know, for example, long-term care facilities, you have providers coming in who might be asymptomatic who are providing care to vulnerable patients. In manufacturing, you have people standing close together, working, you know, in rooms where there are might not be amazing ventilation, and so they're clustered, and again you bring in this asymptomatic person who is shedding virus, and in either of these situations you can have rapid spread of the disease.
Well, you mentioned long-term care facilities, and we've had quite a few cases in those kinds of nursing home and congregate home environments in the area here. Is an issue of age and underlying condition, and what would be the best practices for those facilities and those caregivers?
So I think that while we associate severity of infection with more vulnerable populations, including the elderly and those who might be immunocompromised or have other comorbidities, it's really important to remember that anyone can get sick with coronavirus. And I say that because that becomes really important when you're making decisions about social distancing. What I really appreciate about the employees of the long-term care facility that my mom resides in is their diligence and determination to make personal and professional choices that keep them safe and reduce their risk of being exposed to coronavirus and hence exposing their patients. And, you know, I think when we think about heroes in this battle against coronavirus, I think long-term care facility employees who are committed to making those hard choices that limit their risk of exposure to coronavirus so they can safely provide care to their patients, they are the biggest heroes in my mind.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is one of the leaders of the national response to the coronavirus pandemic, has said he has reservations about some of the ways states are opening up, kind of trying to return to some semblance of normalcy because the economy has been severely impacted. People have been getting a little cabin fever, too, I suspect. But what do you say about the course of this disease? There's a suggestion that it's going to come back. It's not that it's gone away, but that might be another wave of COVID, a spike in the fall, for example, when higher education campuses are perhaps thinking of opening up. What is the advice you're offering to the executive branch of North Dakota about that kind of planning?
So I think that the executive branch has done a really good job of reminding people of the core tenets of social distancing and good hygiene. Yet they've opened up the capacity for personal responsibility and personal choice to help mitigate the effects on social, emotional health, and financial health. And so that leaves us each with this responsibility of really assessing our risks and making healthy choices that balance physical, emotional, social, spiritual, and financial health. And that is that's exhausting, honestly. It was much easier when the state and national government had things shut down, because then there really were very few choices. You know, you were supposed to stay at home, period. So now that we are offered more choices, just like I tell my teenage kids, that means there's more responsibility involved in making those choices.
And some people seem to want to make a statement about this as though it's a political thing. You know, I won't wear a mask or I'll do this or that. And I guess the concern others might have is, well, it's not just your life. It's whoever you might share the virus with.
Right, exactly. And going back to that illustration of the dedicated long-term care facility employee who's making lots of personal sacrifices to reduce their risk of transmission of COVID to one of their patients, yet they have to go to the grocery store to pick up groceries for their family. It would be really nice if the rest of us would be supportive and do our part to decrease risk of potential asymptomatic or symptomatic spread to those people who we're relying on to take care of our loved ones.
When I go to the grocery store, I see everybody who works there wearing a mask and in some cases gloves and cleaning things. I see about half of the customers in masks, so that raises that issue. Let me ask you some specific questions about you know, common utilities and places we go. Would you get on a flight right now?
Well, so I am a physician and I'm also married to a physician. So for me personally, I take social distancing. I mean, it's really important to me because I am concerned not only about transmitting infection to my patients, but I'm also very concerned about transmitting infection to my husband because then he would transmit infection to his patients. So for me personally, I would not get on a flight because I'd be very concerned about potential transmission to other people since I work in a high-risk job, and I wouldn't want to acquire the infection and transmit it to my patients.
So I suspect the same answer would be if you were getting or thinking of going on a cruise ship or going to a big concert or to a Bison game. But how about a restaurant?
So again, I am pretty much on that end of I really don't ever want to be responsible for someone else getting coronavirus.
Yes.
And I am really enjoying takeout food and spending some time at home, because for years and years I've been on the run between my job and my very active children. So I'm still happy to do takeout. Yet, I think when you present these questions to people who really do have a lot of cabin fever, who are really suffering emotionally from this, that there are very safe ways to do many of these things.
Well, I noted today that when I went online that the restaurants in Wuhan, China are still closed. They've opened up a number of businesses there and things have returned to some semblance of normalcy, but you still can't sit down in a restaurant. Let's talk about what might be promising therapies. The president has been talking about hydroxychloroquine, which is a malaria treatment and I guess a treatment for lupus and arthritis. But there are some promising therapies, aren't there? Remdesivir, is that being used in some cases?
Yes, yeah, so that's an antiviral agent that the end of April, an investigational trial that was going on in many centers around the United States showed a lot of promise in decreasing the duration of illness. So much promise that they halted the trial, because when they have such statistically significant evidence in support of a treatment, ethically it is necessary to offer that treatment to the placebo group. And so that ends the trial. And so we are very hopeful that that might be part of the solution for patients, particularly if it's introduced early in the course of illness.
And there has been some promising news. I guess it's a little premature to say that there's more than hope here, but that a vaccine is apparently many options for vaccines are in the works. One in particular has been getting some attention that might even be available as early as early 2021, which would be quite a brief time for the development and distribution of a vaccine. What's your feeling about the state of research and development in finding an effective vaccine for COVID-19?
Well, when I think back to the fact that this virus is now literally 6 months old. I mean, I think it was November 19th that they discovered that, oh, there's this very concerning virus in Wuhan, China. And I think about all of the things we have learned about coronavirus, I am amazed and awestruck. So the fact that we actually have potential vaccines in the pipeline, I think that's incredible.
Dr. Joan Connell is chair of the Physician Advisory Committee for the North Dakota Department of Health. Dr. Connell, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We are all trying to stay connected, whether it's for work.
It has been really amazing to see how much people are getting done without having to meet face-to-face. I'm sure there will be.
Or for less official business.
We figured out rules for virtual beer pong.
The easiest way to stay connected is a way that's always been there for you. Morning Edition from NPR News, every weekday.
Morning Edition, weekdays beginning at 4 a.m. Central, 3 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Last Thursday, our featured guest was Peter Bick, a professor and filmmaker who spent years documenting sustainable agriculture practices. Our conversation started with his description of how climate change and sustainability became his focus.
Well, this place being celebrating farmers who are working with nature, I came to it from the perspective of climate change. I made a movie in 2011 called Carbon Nation, and that film's about solutions to climate change. And in that film and in that research, I learned about farmers who were focusing on nature, focusing on their soils, and were drawing down enormous amounts of carbon from the atmosphere, storing it in their soils, where it is basically the currency for all good things to happen. The microbes love the carbon, the plants love the carbon, and the animals that feed on the plants love those plants to be nutrient dense. And so I started making a film called Soil Carbon Cowboys back in 2013, and that introduced me to Alan Williams and Gabe Brown and Neil Dennis up in Saskatchewan, just north of y'all, and showed me what it felt like to stand on a ranch, on a that was so healthy, so alive, so vibrant, that you knew something was really good there. You knew something was really good happening. And then you find out the farmers are getting themselves out of debt by focusing on nature. And that's why I'm here. I started this thing worrying about the climate, and now I'm an advocate for farmers. I think the fact that we pay farmers so little in this country and farmers are in so much stress and debt, I think it's a crime. And the farmers that I've been filming in our series, Carbon Cowboys, they're happy people. They're working hard. They have challenges, but they're focusing on nature first, and it's a huge stress reliever for them rather than fighting nature and fighting with all the chemicals they used to use.
Well, I went online. There's a lot of information at carboncowboys.org and found out a little bit about you. You're a professor of practice at Arizona State University in both the School of Sustainability and the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communications, where you teach students to make short documentary films about sustainability solutions. What got you engaged in sustainability solutions, that whole field? That's a very specific area.
It is, in a way. And then you think about it, and it's how do we make the planet better? So it's quite broad. All the films I've made since I was in film school, getting into film school, have always had something about the environment in them. The first feature documentary I made was called Garbage. And then the second feature documentary I made was Carbonation, which was a climate change solutions movie that doesn't even care if you believe in climate change. And the reason we called it that was because there was a lot of really smart people like my Uncle Phil and other people who were confused or not buying the arguments for climate change, but they still would understand an argument for using less energy, for being energy efficient, for having national security being a priority. And if we don't need to be buying oil from the Middle East, that's a national security issue. So that's how I started focusing in on it. And then when I found out about soils and I found out about what we're calling adaptive multi-paddock grazing, it was so powerful and it was so so engaging with the farmers and the ability to draw down so much carbon from the atmosphere and then have it do so much good on the land. That's been my focus now since 2012, and I'm not bored. I'm very engaged. I want every farmer in the United States to be focused on their soil health, and I want every farmer in the United States, I want the metric they use to be profit per acre, not bushels per acre or pounds per acre, but profit per acre. And I think if you focus on nature and you focus on profit per acre, the farmers I know, they're doing really well.
Peter Bick is a filmmaker. He's also a professor of practice at the Arizona State University. We're talking about Carbon Cowboys. This is a documentary series of short films shot over 6 years in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. And you talk about carbon mitigation and various ways to do that. I saw some fascinating examples when I sampled one of these short pieces. What would you describe as the principal and most efficient and effective ways to mitigate carbon use as you explore it in Carbon Cowboys?
Well, the reason we're focused on soils is because I think that that's a great solution for bringing down carbon from the atmosphere. Where, you know, at a certain level, carbon in the atmosphere is keeping us all alive, but we've exceeded that level. We've nearly doubled it. And a lot of the carbon in the atmosphere, maybe up to a fifth of it, is actually from our soils, from overplowing. And all of a sudden that soil, the carbon in the soil is airborne, binds with oxygen, becomes CO2, and it goes on up and warms the atmosphere for a long time, 100 years. All the carbon that Elvis ever emitted when he was a truck driver before he became famous, all that carbon's still up in the atmosphere. Uh-huh. And so when you have photosynthesis happening, that's drawing the carbon back down. And what's happening with these farmers and ranchers is they're emulating the way bison moved across the Great Plains. The herds were always densely packed, and the animals would only eat about half the forage that was available, and then they would move on. So you'd have this herd with a lot of manure evenly spread, a lot of urine evenly spread because they're so well packed. They're eating all the plants, not just the bits and bobs they want, and they eat half of it. They stomp the rest down, and then they move on. So what happens after they move on? The plants then go into photosynthetic overdrive, right, because they want to grow again. So they're drawing down carbon at an enormous rate. The soil is covered because they've stomped the rest of that forage down, given the soil a nice cover so it stays cool and moist so it doesn't lose any water. And all those microbes down in the soil, they're just eating up all that carbon that the plants are shooting down there. You know, the plants take CO2 out of the atmosphere. They slough off the O2. They don't need oxygen. We do. And then they take that carbon, they mix it with water, and they create a bunch of sugars. And those sugars then become the groceries for all the soil microbial life. In a healthy prairie and on a lot of these farms, they have a lot of different plants growing, right? You want that biodiversity of plant life. And so when you have a biodiversity of plant life above ground, you have a super biodiversity of microbial life below ground. And so that whole community is working together. Some microbes are drilling into rocks, the fungi, and getting nutrients out of those rocks that the plant could never get. They're getting other micronutrients from other places, the bacteria. And so the plant is feeding the soil life below ground with all that carbon from the atmosphere. And then the soil life is feeding the plants all those nutrients. And so it's a great symbiotic system that makes the plants that much more productive, that much more nutrient dense. So, you know, in 30, 60, 90 days when the cows are coming back to graze again on the farms that I'm studying, because they let them rest for that period of time, they've got an amazing amount of forage and amazingly nutrient dense forage. So these farmers are able to raise on the same land with the same rainfall 2, 3, 4 times as many animals as they were before. And that's money. And they're able to graze that land 10 or 11 months out of the year. Therefore, they don't need hay for 3 or 4 months. And that's big money. And they're not growing their own hay and fertilizing their fields and taking all that time, because they're producing enough forage on their land to feed their animals, where they might just bring in hay for December or maybe bring in hay for January. And Gabe Brown in Bismarck, he grazes all year long. I'm sure he has some hay in the winter, but they're out there grazing. I know a lot of folks who say that their animals, when they're out in the, you know, in the cold and in the snow even, that they would prefer to go graze and dig through the snow to get to the grasses out there than to eat the hay during the wintertime. So it's an amazing system of using nature to allow these farmers to lower their operating costs and increase their profits.
We spoke to Gabe Brown, a North Dakota farmer in the Bismarck area, and he's a regenerative no-till pioneer, last November. And he talked about a pilot project which will span 50,000 acres of farmland from Kansas to Canada with a group of 45 farmers. So that's a project that's underway. I guess we'll see what it turns up.
Yep.
But in your documentaries, you talk about this synthesis, and you've just referenced it a bit, art and science and history, the way the bison herds would roam around and just find what looked good.
Yep.
And so that instead of farmers planting alfalfa or some sort of feed crop, they literally let whatever nature's abundance would turn up, and the animals are put into these sort of quickly set up paddocks, grazing paddocks, and eat a variety of stuff that we used to call weeds.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of nutrients in those weeds and a lot of protein in those weeds. And as Alan Williams says in our first one of these short films, Soil Carbon Cowboys, if it's forage, then it's not a weed. And so it's all about variety. The animals, there's a great professor out of Utah State. I think he's since fully retired. His name's Fred Provenza. He's got this great research that shows that if you give a grazing animal the choices that a prairie would naturally have, they will know when to eat what kind of food to balance out their own diet. If you just give an animal 1 or 2 or 3 types of food to eat, they're not getting the biodiversity that they need to actually be balancing out their own diet and their own gut microbiome. You know, we all have a gut microbiome that's very interesting how it matches up sometimes with the soil microbiome. And how are these systems talking to each other? I think we're just scratching the surface on that. But if you look at a prairie, I mean, what, is there 100 different types of plants, 50 different types of plants? And so what's happening on the farms and ranches that we're filming is they're letting as many different types of forage grow, and then they're planting other stuff. They're playing with cocktail mixes of different types of plants to see what works for what system and what works for what animals. And, you know, if they've got compacted soil, then they're planting these radishes that poke through that hard compacted soil and let water go into there. And it's a big experiment right now. And the farmers and ranchers, they're loving the creativity that they get to play with. It's not a recipe card type of farming. And they all say, this is what's really interesting, is people think, well, you're going to take all those animals, you're going to put up an electric fence, and you're going to move them 3 or 4 times a day during the growing season, as a lot of these farmers do. That must be more work. I don't have enough people working for me, on and on. But what all these farmers say is that it's actually either the same amount of work, just different. You're not on your tractor and you're not baling hay, but you're out with your animals, or it's just a lot less work. And that's what I hear all the time from the farmers that we've been working with, that it's a lot less work. And a lot of people don't understand that, but I would just highly recommend, go visit a farmer near you who's doing this type of grazing, and just get on their land and feel how squishy the soil is, see all the bugs, understand that the birds are choosing that land to breed their babies, and smell it, and smell the soil, dig into the soil and see, because the answers are all right there.
CarbonCowboys.org is the website with a lot of this information as well. And Peter, you mentioned how quickly and creatively some of these people that you focus on for these short documentaries have adapted their lives and their ways of doing the ranching. Well, the fellow in Saskatchewan,
Neil Dennis, and he's putting 850 head into that quarter acre for 2 hours.
That's intense.
And then he's opening up another quarter acre for the next 2 hours, and the animals, these quarter acres, he builds a bunch of them in a row for the day, and he has a battery latch that opens them automatically every 2 hours, and the animals naturally go into the new paddock each time that battery latch opens. They don't have to be, he's not sitting there telling them what to do, he's not calling them, they just do it because they know the forage is better. And then he has this water tank that it's portable, so he didn't even have to wire, you know, put a bunch of pipes throughout his ranch, which a lot of people do. He just has this water truck that he fills once a year with a tank full of diesel fuel, and he takes this water trough and he puts it on the edge of all of those paddocks so the animals can walk back to the water anytime they want, and then they can go eat new fresh produce anytime they want. And he's like sitting at home watching Oprah while all that's happening.
Yeah, he had a great line there. He said if he'd started this earlier, he might have 15 kids because he'd have so much time on his hands.
I know.
So is this catching on, regenerative grazing?
It is. It's still small in the scheme of things. It's still about 2% of American farmers, but it's catching on. So Alan Williams and Gabe Brown, two of the farmers in our first film that Neil Dennis is in, they've started a group called the Soil Health Academy, and they run workshops. Alan is on the road probably 250 days of the year teaching. And when we started making the films back in 2013, they would have 50 people, maybe. And they'd have field days that had more people, but a lot of these workshops, about 50, 75 people. Now the workshops are much larger, and the field days are much larger, and they're all selling out, and they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so I think we need many, many more folks like Gabe and Alan and their partner Ray Archuleta and all the people. So they're now teaching the teachers, right? So it's about scale, right? It's about teaching as many people to learn these things, and then they teach people. And so the way I see what I can do in this ecosystem is that I can tell these stories and I can make these films, because Carbon Cowboys, the series that's up right now, it's 10 short films from 10 very different ecosystems. You know, there's this thing that I call the yeah, but syndrome. You know, it'll work in Alabama, but it won't work in Mississippi. Or it'll work on your farm, but it won't work on mine, when there's just a fence between the two farms. I've heard that said. And the point is that these principles work from the Sonoran Desert to Mississippi to Saskatchewan to California, Kentucky. They just work. You just go and you see it happening. And so now it's a question of what Alan likes to say when he does one of his workshops. He says, you can't say it won't work where you live, but you can always ask, how do I get this to work where I live? And if our films can help that dialogue go and get folks curious and see how we can help people learn that we want them to be more productive. We want their land to be more productive. We know every farmer cares about their land. That's a no-brainer. And so what if these new methods, which are kind of based on old methods with some new applications, what if they make your land that much better and make your life that much better? Well, for me, as an American citizen who thinks that food security is about the most important national security issue we have, I want to get this message to as many farmers as possible because I want the farmers to be prosperous.
Well, you mentioned Alan Williams. He's a PhD, and he farms around Starkville, Mississippi, where they have more than 45 inches of annual rainfall compared with the semi-arid areas of North Dakota and Saskatchewan that you were previewing with the other farmers.
Yeah, so, there's a big difference there, right?
Huge difference. And I remember Gabe Brown was saying that on his land that was around Bismarck, if he got a half-inch rainfall at one point, that was all that they could handle. Otherwise, it would pool. Now he says he can get 8 inches in an hour and accommodate it. So apparently, that soil that he's been working on for a while now has become more efficient at doing what he wants to do.
Yeah, well, when you focus on soil health, a healthy soil is a very vibrant community of a lot of microorganisms. And a lot of those plants, when they get eaten at the top, they're sort of mirror image of the roots down below. That sort of dies off. And so healthy soils are this buildup of old dead roots and old dead microbes, and they're not compacted. And so they become like a sponge. And so as a sponge would be, they would soak up a lot more water in a rainfall event where it's inches in an hour that they can absorb. And that's what they call effective rainfall. Like, it might rain an inch on your property, but did you soak it all up or did it wash off? And when it washed off, did it wash off your topsoil with it? Because you can lose tons of topsoil in one big rain event if your soil is not covered, right? If you've just plowed and you've just planted, you've got, you know, it's a dangerous situation there for you. But if you have your soils covered, then they're not going to, the water's going to stay in there in the summer when it gets dry. It's going to be cooler. That it's like a 40 degree temperature difference between exposed soil in the summer and covered soil in the summer. It's an astounding temperature difference, even in North Dakota. I've seen the measurements there. And when you have that healthy soil, it actually makes your farm a lot more resilient in drought as well, because it's holding on to that water longer. And because you have their soil covered, it's holding on to that water longer. But you know, where you all are, you guys have winter, right? And Neil Dennis up in Saskatchewan, he was seeing that his forage was growing a good 3 weeks longer into the fall than his neighbors, because his soil microbial life was that much more robust and still creating heat, creating life. And that in the spring, he was seeing his forage start to grow a good 3 weeks long earlier than his neighbors and than his used to, because his microbial life was coming to life and was actually starting to heat things up. So he was getting about 6 weeks more growing season in a short growing season up north than his neighbor. And again, that's just money. That's just money in the bank.
Your carbon cowboys talk about the cost effectiveness of their operations. Are schools of agriculture and state departments of ag getting behind this?
I think that's been slow. There are definitely people within the USDA and the NRCS that understand this. One specific fellow is Doug Peterson, who we film in one of our short films. It's called I Sell Water and Sunshine. He's out of Missouri. So he's been talking about this for decades. And then there's a guy up in Bismarck. I think he's retired. His name is Jay Fuhrer. Man, what an amazing man, amazingly smart human being. I had a conversation with him, about 6 months ago, and I learned so much in that one conversation with him. So these are folks from the USDA. There's a guy named Greg Brand in Tennessee. He's been talking about soil health and how do you maximize your soil health for a long time. I don't know if it's a majority of people in the USDA yet, but I know it's growing. And I know there's really smart people there that understand that our soils are in really dangerous condition as a whole across the country, and not just the United States, but across the world. But, you know, if we don't get those soils back into good shape, we don't have food security. And that is, like I said earlier, to me, one of the most important ingredients of national security is being able to feed yourself. Let's feed ourselves. Let's help feed the world sometimes. But let's take care of our farms and our communities, and we'll go from there.
Carbon Cowboys is the series of short films that created a documentary shot over 6 years in the U.S., Canada, and the United Kingdom. Peter Bick is the filmmaker. And what's your next project, Peter?
Well, what a lot of people have been asking is, are these farms actually drawing down carbon at a scale that would slow down climate change? And then the question quickly becomes, what about the methane and what about the nitrous oxide? And so we at ASU and a lot of other universities have put together a large research project that is going to answer these questions. We're going to compare the adaptive regenerative grazing on one side of the fence with conventional farmer grazer on the other side of the fence. And we're going to measure all of these metrics, soil carbon, water infiltration, breeding bird populations, bugs above and below ground, greenhouse gas cycling, microbial life, animal well-being, farmer well-being. And so this is a large research project that we've got going right now. McDonald's is our biggest funder. And so we're now making a movie as well about that research. It's on 10 farms in the Southeast U.S., and so we're working on getting the data analyzed. We started in the field in 2018, so we're in our third year now, and my editors are working really hard to edit the footage. So that's the next project. We don't know the name of it, but at our carboncowboys.org website, the information will be there when we have this project going, when we start having articles published in scientific journals, and when our film starts coming out, it'll all be there.
Peter Bick is the founder and president of Carbon Nation, an environmental film nonprofit, and he's also a professor of practice at Arizona State University in both the School of Sustainability and the School of Journalism and Mass Communications. Peter, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Doug. I really appreciate it.
In an ever-accelerating world, NPR's Morning Edition slows the news down.
Let's work through what happened in what order as best you know right now.
Take a second look and own your morning with Morning Edition from NPR News.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.